This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast.
Oh, yeah.
Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Clap your hands.
Good morning, listeners. You're on the Monday Breakfast Show here at 3CR on 8:55 a.m. on the dial. It's just me in the studio today. No Rob or Edmi this morning. It's just me and the steward hanging out on a beautiful Melbourne cold morning. It's daylight savings. The days are getting longer. Things are looking up. The seasonal depression is leaving. Hallelujah. And I think it's going to be 17 degrees today, but this week it's going to be hot. It's going to be 17 degrees today, no rain here in Nam. Tomorrow's going to be 20. Wednesday's going to be 25 and sunny. Thursday, it's going to be 30 degrees. What? Anyway. So, today on the show, we have a pretty great show for you listeners. First, we're going to hear an interview from Indigenous Rights Radio. Joseph Lee interviewed a member of the Akuina Mapoanag Nation speaking on the Land Back Movement, which is the traditional owner of Massachusetts in the US. And then secondly, we're going to be listening back to the Yilliman Show, where Kieran will be sharing his analysis of liberalism. After that, we'll be hearing an excerpt from Queer History's Queer Futures podcast about the criminalisation of LGBTQIA+ people. And then after that, we're going to be listening back to Marissa from the Doin' Time Show, interviewing Bo Spearham, here at 3CR on the Frontier Wars, Police Powers and Aboriginal Deaths in Custody. And then we're going to end the show with revisiting three interviews from 2024 on the history of Maria Corina Machado, the 2025 Nobel Peace Prize winner that was released on Friday. But first up, we got the headlines.
Some folks know about it, some don't. Some will learn to shout it, some won't. But sooner or later, baby, here's a ditty. Say you're gonna have to get right down to the real nitty-gritty. Let's get right down to the real nitty-gritty. Now, one, two, nitty-gritty. Now, yeah, boom, nitty-gritty. Keep repeating, right down.
These are the news headlines for Monday, the 13th of October, 2025. Last Friday, on World Homeless Day and World Mental Health Day, new figures from Homelessness Australia revealed that domestic and family violence remains the leading cause of homelessness across the country, with the crisis deepening in Victoria. According to analysis of national data from the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare, more than 35,000 people across Australia sought homelessness help in 2025 due to family and domestic violence, an increase of 13% over the last 2 years. In the same month, 14,520 Victorians were driven to seek support for the same reason, up from 13,675 of the previous year. Of those, more than 10,700 of them were women. Kate Colvin, CEO of Homelessness Australia, said, quote, "These numbers are devastating but not surprising," end quote. "Australians have been calling attention to domestic and family violence and the housing crisis for years. This data clearly shows that governments have not done enough to stop the rising homelessness and protect victim survivors of violence," end quote. Another top reasons for homelessness in June included eviction, financial hardship, and housing affordability stress, with the latter up 8.1% nationally since 2023. Homelessness Australia is now calling on the federal government to act urgently in the upcoming mid-year economic and fiscal outlook, pushing for early intervention programs, increased income support, and a major boost in social housing. Kate Colvin also said, quote, "Homelessness is not just a housing issue, it's a mental health issue," end quote. "The stress and risks of homelessness take a devastating toll. A secure home and to support to keep it are the foundations for mental well-being. We have so much to gain if we act now," end quote. Also in news this week, bulldozers have begun clearing the rubble in Gaza City after 2 years of devastating genocide, as tens of thousands of forcibly displaced Palestinians make their way back to their destroyed homes in northern Gaza. The cleanup effort comes as preparations begin for a high-stakes ceasefire summit in Egypt's Sharm el-Sheikh, where President US Donald Trump is expected to attend alongside regional leaders. As a part of the ceasefire agreement between Israel and Hamas, Israel has started transferring Palestinian prisons to two separate jails ahead of their expected release. Mirrored by Hamas, which is preparing to release Israeli captives held in Gaza. Since October 2023, Israel's assault on Gaza has killed at least 67,682 people and injured over 170,000. During the October 7 attacks, 1,139 people were killed and around 200 hostages were taken to Gaza. Meanwhile, violence continues in the occupied West Bank. A young Palestinian man was shot and wounded in the hand during an Israeli military raid of the town of Yatta, south of Hebron. According to local media activist Osama Makamara, Israeli forces stormed homes belonging to families of three Palestinians held in Israeli prisons. The injured man was taken to Yatta Governmental Hospital, where he is reported to be in stable condition. These have been the news headlines for the 13th of October. You're listening to 3CR at 8:55 a.m.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings, cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
The state government has sold 578 hectares of public land to private developers. They're building a private-public partnership model housing over public housing land, and it's just not on.
Housing is just massively expensive. It's never been effective in this country to rely on the market to provide decent housing for people.
Rent has risen by 21%. That's median rent across the country as of January this year.
As the rents keep rising, so must we. And we must stand together as a collective, because this war cannot be won by the few. It will only be victorious by the many.
3CR. Stay tuned. Stay radical.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show here at 3CR on 855 AM on the dial. First up, we're going to be listening to an interview from Indigenous Rights Radio, interviewing Joseph Lee, a member of the Akwina Wampanoag Nation, speaking on the Land Back Movement.
Remember your children, remember our future, remember your children, remember Mother Nature.
The Global Land Back Movement is a collective effort made by Indigenous communities to reclaim land lost to colonialism. This movement, active in the US, Australia, Canada, and other countries, seeks to reclaim land stolen for various reasons, including conservation, industry, and perceived progress. Journalist Joseph Lee, the author of a book titled Nothing More of This Land, focuses on his community, the Akwina Wampanoag, who are working to reclaim their ancestral lands on Martha's Vineyard, which have been largely lost to expensive vacation homes and high property taxes. Indigenous communities, recognized as the best stewards of the environment, often initiate these reclamation efforts through fundraising, donations, or direct actions, while governments and corporations often resist. Joseph Lee says that there is a growing recognition among non-Indigenous communities that working with Native peoples is crucial for environmental protection. The Land Back Movement is a continuous struggle that, while evolving in form, maintains the core purpose of asserting Indigenous peoples' rights and connection to the land, which is central to their culture and identity.
My name is Joseph Lee. I'm a Akwina Wampanoag journalist based in New York City. Land Back is, in many ways, a global Indigenous movement to reclaim land that was lost, stolen, degraded, violated by colonialism and colonial forces. And as we know, those colonial forces have existed across centuries, across generations, different eras. Sometimes it's land theft in the name of conservation, sometimes land theft in the name of industry, land theft in the name of progress. There are all sorts of things. And so Land Back is a movement, I think a global movement, led by Indigenous communities to take that land back. And here in the U.S., Land Back has existed in many forms. There's tribes who are raising funds to buy back their land. There are tribes who are getting land donated back to them. And it's all trying to reclaim land and reclaim stewardship and remake those connections to land and to community. And I think it's part of a really exciting moment globally where Indigenous peoples are doing this across the world. So my book, Nothing More of This Land, talks about my community, the Akwina Wampanoag, and where we're located is a small island called Massachusetts on the east coast of the United States. And it's a place that's known for being a kind of fancy vacation destination, and we've lost a lot of our land to these very expensive homes. Tax property values are really high. We can't afford to live there anymore. Tourism is a big issue that we're dealing with. And so that's the story that I begin to tell in the book and try to unpack our relationship with land and how we've lost land, but also trying to reclaim land. And we've reclaimed land through a number of processes, sometimes buying it, sometimes being given land. But there's always more that we're trying to do. And then to be able to use that land in a way that makes sense for our community. And then in the book I go from our own my own tribe and our community to broaden out into this national and international conversation of land back, indigenous rights, sovereignty, and trying to understand what that looks like and all the different approaches different tribes, nations, and communities have, and trying to learn from each other, because I think this is it's a global struggle. I think in the U.S. there are different examples. One of them that I could highlight is we see now that, you know, we know that indigenous peoples are the best stewards of land. They know environmentally what the land needs and what makes sense for the land and for the people and the animals and the water. And in the U.S., there's a growing understanding from non-indigenous communities that indigenous peoples are the best stewards of land. And because of that, it's opening doors for us to allow people to see, if you want to protect and conserve the environment, you need to work with indigenous peoples and you need to let them have some sort of control or input over the land. And so I think that's where it's starting here, and that's leading to some exciting opportunities. But of course, governments, corporations are always pushing back against indigenous sovereignty and indigenous power. And so that's always an ongoing thing. And so I think it starts from the indigenous community asserting itself and taking the initiative. And it's always a fight, but I think hopefully more and more opportunities are beginning to open up. It's always challenging, and it's been challenging for generations and centuries, and it will continue to be challenging. But I also think that there's a lot of hope and inspiration, and indigenous peoples are always pushing and trying new things and innovating. And I think that's very exciting. And, you know, I think the challenges evolve over the years. You know, we've talked about maybe it used to be more violent theft and industry, and now it's taking the form of conservation and environmental, supposed environmentalism. And so we see the form changes, but I think the purpose is the same, and the purpose is to strip indigenous peoples of their land and rights. And so that's what we're seeing. There are no indigenous people without the land, and the relationship between indigenous peoples and the land is everything, and that's the heart of culture and community and sovereignty and everything that's important. And there's such a strong relationship between indigenous peoples and the land and environment, and that's what indigenous peoples around the world are fighting for right now. And so I think that's the challenge, is to assert that and find ways to make that work. We need to learn from each other and find ways to connect. I think in many ways the purpose of colonialism is to divide us and not allow us to see those connections. But I think when we can see those connections, there's a lot that we can find. Remember your
children. For more information on the rights of indigenous peoples, visit cs.org and follow Cultural Survival on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, Threads, and Blue Sky. Your children remember our future.
The global land back movement is a collective and deeply rooted effort by indigenous communities to reclaim ancestral lands that were taken through colonization, forced removal, and broken treaties. Far beyond a call for restitution, land back is about restoring sovereignty, cultural revitalization, and environmental hardship. It is a continuous and evolving struggle to reassert indigenous rights and reaffirm the sacred reciprocal relationship between people and the land, a relationship that has sustained ecosystems for millennia. We just heard an interview from Indigenous Rights Radio with Dev Kumar Sunawa interviewing Joseph Lee, a member of Akwina Wampanoag Nation, the traditional owners of Massachusetts in the U.S.
Palestine. Your station, your voice.
Palestine is not just the land of the Muslims. It's the land of three people and all people. The land of the Muslims, the land of the Christians, and the land of the Jews who are decent and not Zionist Jews. When we say from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, that does not mean that we are going to get rid of the Jews from that land. We are saying there's going to be one state of Palestine, the historic Palestine, where the Jews and the Christians and the Muslims can live side by side peacefully.
3CR, your station, your voice.
Shahadat miladu kufi tibetu Yep. Hey, it's time to bring my lyrics into the mix. Bit of hip-hop on top of the beat real quick. Yo, we never fold, never quit. Remain unseen just like an endless pit. Underground making sound till the curtains raise. And our music is found in the crowds we amaze. Proud of my heritage, more the percentages. Bigger and better than Versace with a membership. Time to change and the world is racing. But I'm back with the raps to make sure we make it. On a page of information like the Matrix. I'm near reloaded back like it's basic. It's just the way I'm descending. Elegant fresh with the styles we're bending. Mix it up like a stir fry. Looking at into the world with the bird's eye. Looking at into the world with the bird's eye. Yeah. Break, 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 break it down like this. Everybody move to the rhythm of the ditch. Old and I knew, yes, we beat the bridge. I bet you never heard a sound like this. Break it down like this. Everybody move to the rhythm of the ditch. Old and I knew, yes, we beat the bridge. I bet you never heard a sound like this. Break it down like this. A lot, of friends, lot of enemies, lot of funerals, lot of faces. Overseas, some lost in my memory. Gotta stay mentally equipped. Never gonna stop, never gonna quit. When the lows come, I'll face it with force. Don't wanna back down, don't wanna get it lost. When it comes around to people trying to play God, imagine what commies thinking with his thoughts. I catch no air like Mayweather. You dwell way down on a lower level. Yo, I act so swell like a Mayweather. But I'm trained in hell like a purple devil. Now aiming for the double cliff, turn up the bass a bit. If you wanna make a list, mention this verse I'll spit. At the same time, representing my people. Taking a stand against evil, against evil, against evil. Taking a stand against evil. Break it down like this. Everybody move to the rhythm of the ditch. Old and I knew, yes, we beat the bridge. I bet you never heard a sound like this. Break it down like this. Everybody move to the rhythm of the ditch. Old and I knew, yes, we beat the bridge. I bet you never heard a sound like this. Break it down like this. Everybody move to the rhythm of the ditch. Old and the new, yes, we beat the bridge. I bet you never heard a sound like this. Break it down like this. Everybody move to the rhythm of the ditch. Old and the new, yes, we beat the bridge. I bet you never heard a sound like this. Break it down like this. Break it down. I bet you never heard a sound like this. Break it down. Break it. I bet you never heard a sound like this. Yeah.
That was Break It Down by Jocka. Up next, we're going to be listening back to a segment from the Yellerman Show, where Kieran will be sharing his analysis of liberalism. He'll be explaining the frameworks of liberalism, explaining why liberalism is the foundation of the colonial system, and provides examples of how liberal ideology manifests both politically and socially throughout daily life in so-called Australia.
Welcome. On today's show, we're going to be talking a bit about liberalism again. Now, you know I often bring up this subject and I often speak about this on the show, but that's because it's so relevant. It is such an important topic to cover, and it's a very large topic to cover as well. It is so relevant because, you know, it's not something that is abstract or distant, but it's very much the political and social framework that defines the everyday life here in so-called Australia. Now, when people hear liberal or liberalism, you know, there's a few things that they might think about, or a few things that might come to mind. You know, first and foremost, of course, there's the Liberal National Party. We're not talking about the Liberal Party, although they definitely do fall in the confines of liberalism. You know, if you're a bit more of a conservative leaning, which is unlikely if you're listening to this show, but, you know, if you are, or if you know people in your life that are, You know, when you talk about liberalism to them, they might associate liberalism with, you know, so-called woke culture or with a more progressive outlook. It's not. If you're somebody who leans left, which I would assume you are if you're a regular listener of this show, if you're somebody who leans left or, you know, identifies as some sort of communist or Marxist or socialist or anarchist or progressive or whatever else, you know, you might view liberalism as either a good thing or a bad thing, depending where you fit on the spectrum. You know, you might view it as a ideology that you identify with, or you might be very critical of it. But today we're going to talk a bit about, like, you know, the overarching formation of liberalism and the form that it takes within society. So, you know, when people hear about this, they might often also think of, like, personal freedoms, for example. But, you know, liberalism is much more than that. What liberalism actually is the dominant political theory of the modern world. It is the foundation of the colonial system of this continent as well. You know, the political ideology that not only founded the colonization of this continent, but very much justified it, pardon me, very much justified it, and continues today to justify imperialism and capitalism and the colonial occupation here, but we'll get onto that. You know, it's something that has been quite often presented as well as the, you know, so-called common sense of politics. You know, and when I say that, I'm talking about, like, the way that liberalism frames, you know, a commitment to so-called freedom and equality and progress. But, you know, when we actually look closer, when we actually view what liberalism is, we see that those values are always defined in ways that serve the powerful and preserve the system as it currently stands, the capital colonial system, that is. Now, liberalism is the language of rights, apparently. You know, it very much talks about personal freedoms and whatever else, but it's a lot more than that as well. I suppose the best way to explain it is liberalism can be viewed on three different levels. It can be viewed as a political theory. It can be viewed through the way that it is the primary structure of the colonial governance of this continent and colonial government here. And it can also be viewed very much on an interpersonal level in the way that we interact with each other and the relationships we have with each other, as well as the way that we act, just generally speaking. Now, on that last note, you know, Mao Zedong is somebody who very much talked about that in his work, Combat Liberalism. But if you are somebody who might identify as a Marxist or a communist, I've heard this quite a lot from a lot of, you know, settler communists here. You know, a lot of settler communists don't view the liberalism that Mao spoke about as actually being liberalism. You know, they view liberalism as this political theory, but that whole analysis actually misses the way that liberalism manifests on an individual level. And in fact, you know, I'm just going to be blunt here. You know, most of the settlers on this continent who do identify on the left, whether it be communist or anarchist or socialist or whatever, most of them completely miss entire segments of their analysis of liberalism. You know, they don't actually fully understand it, and they view it as something that is very abstract and, you know, very based in theory and books and whatever else. But as a result, they completely miss what it actually is and the way that it manifests. And I think that, you know, Mao really hit the nail on the head when he produced that pamphlet, Combat Liberalism, and spoke of, you know, I think there was 11 forms of liberalism he spoke about there. But, you know, he really hit the nail on the head because, you know, a lot of these people, they don't understand what liberalism actually is, these settlers here. And, you know, to be fair to them, the reason for that is because they were raised in a liberal society, in a liberal culture, with liberal norms and values and ethics and whatever else. You know, it's just basic sociology 101. If you're raised in a society, you're obviously going to embody the values and the ethics and outlooks of that society. So if you're raised in a liberal society, which these people are, they're obviously going to view society through that liberal lens. And as a result, you know, they're not able to actually take a step back and have a look at the full picture. Now, you know, one of the arguments I hear against this is that there is a political spectrum within Western societies and within, you know, so-called Australia in particular. But that spectrum doesn't mean that liberalism doesn't exist. In fact, you know, or that it isn't as impactful as it is. In fact, you know, that spectrum is a spectrum that exists within the confines of liberalism itself. And in fact, that spectrum just further serves to entrench liberalism in our society because it gives this whole false facade of there being nuance and of there being options and of there being variation and whatever else. But at the end of the day, practically all settler political theories and outlooks and values and ethics and whatever else exist within that spectrum of liberalism. You know, it's something that a lot of settlers don't want to reconcile with either and don't want to acknowledge or accept. You know, when we talk about fascism, for example, you know, fascism exists on the spectrum of liberalism, you know, albeit a far right version of it, but it still exists on that very limited and constricted spectrum of liberalism. And then when we come back to the other side and we look at European notions of communism, again, that exists within the spectrum of liberalism. Now, you know, quite a lot of these settler communists and socialists and Marxists and whatever else, you know, they like to view themselves as being separate from liberal ideology and of being critiques of it and whatever else, you know, critics of it, sorry, and whatever else. But at the end of the day, you know, Marx himself was somebody who was raised in a liberal society with liberal values and ethics and a liberal outlook. And as a result, you know, quite a lot of his theory exists within that spectrum of liberalism. And, you know, it's true. Like, people might try and deny it, and people might, you know, think that it's not true and whatever else, but they're coming from a Eurocentric outlook when they do. You know, their analysis is unable to properly capture their circumstances because they exist within those circumstances. You know, they can't take a step back and see the full picture. But, you know, when we look at Marx, for example, and we look at quite a lot of his writings, quite a lot of it is based in people like John Locke, who was, you know, one of the fathers of liberalism, is based in John Locke's own outlooks. I mean, you know, it was John Locke himself who first put forward this whole notion of, well, in the European world anyways, but this whole notion of, you know, if you mix your blood and sweat with the soil, then you have a claim over those means of production. You know, and then when we look at Marx, it's very much the same thing. You know, the workers should rightfully own the means of production. But, you know, this is, again, it all stems from that same political ideology and that same thought process. It's just different versions of it at the end of the day. But, you know, there's quite a lot of other things. You know, Marx, for example, in his writings on India, he very much supported the, you know, don't get me wrong, he was critical of it, but he very much also supported the colonization and the occupation of India by Britain because he saw it as a way for the people of India to progress towards communism. You know, that's very much a liberal thinking. You know, it bases the whole, I'll tell you why it's liberal thinking, because, you know, it bases the whole outlook of society and the whole outlook of what we define as progress and, you know, the hurdles and markers and whatever else that people have to meet to, you know, be accepted as having progress and whatever else. It bases it all within the outlook of a Eurocentric mindset where development is modernity and modernity is development to phrase Loisier Le Chubre, who is somebody who actually speaks quite a lot about the Eurocentricities of liberalism and the way that liberalism and Eurocentric mindsets are very much tied into each other.
The Common Social Change Library is an online collection of educational resources for those involved in community campaigns and social and labour movements. It collects, curates, and distributes key lessons and resources from progressive movements from around Australia and across the globe. The library includes over 1,400 resources covering campaign strategy, community organising, activist history, digital campaigning, justice, equity, diversity and inclusion, and much, much more. It's free to access the library, so check out the collection at www.commonslibrary.org.
Before that CSA, that was a segment from the 3CR show Yilliman on liberalism and how it is the foundation of the colonial system. To hear the rest of this episode and more of the Yilliman show, go to 3cr.org.au/Yilliman, Yallamin, or tune in to 3CR on Wednesdays from 12 to 1pm. We're now going to hear an excerpt from the Queer Histories, Queer Futures podcast, a 3CR series made in collaboration with Marybeck Council, telling the area's queer history by the people who made it. This segment focuses on complex histories of trauma and resistance relating to queer criminalisation, with excerpts of from speakers Emma Russell and Tex McKenzie, providing history and first-hand accounts on how queer communities have been targeted by police in this colonial state. Listen to more episodes of the Queer Histories, Queer Futures series at 3cr.org.au/Queer Histories, Queer Futures.
My name's Emma Russell. I'm a queer researcher in the Crime, Justice and Legal Studies program at La Trobe University, where I've worked since 2018. I did my PhD at Monash University, and my PhD research looked at contemporary histories of policing queerness and how police violence and police power was recalibrating over the last couple of decades post-decriminalisation of homosexuality in relation to queer communities. I see policing as a tool for maintaining the settler colonial nation state as a heterosexual space, and this is a long-standing pattern in Australia since colonisation. The institution of the police in its various forms since colonisation has used a range of mechanisms of surveillance, patrolling, charging, arresting, as a way of governing what is deemed the appropriate expressions of gender and sexuality. And those understandings of appropriateness are heavily racialized, classed, ableist. All of those things have shaped the way that gender and sexuality have been an object of suspicion and concern for the police force of the settler state. The history of what we might call the criminalisation of homosexuality in Australia dates back to 1851, when English statutes and case law outlawing a range of homosexual offences were applied to the new colony of Victoria. Initially, what was termed the abominable crime of buggery was punishable by death, and following that, men or boys could be sentenced to up to 15 years in prison for having consensual sex. And then over the next century, other so-called crimes were invented to police what was termed vice, or behaviours seen as perverse, which later morphed into signifiers of a particular subject position, i.e. the homosexual. So the offence of gross indecency was adopted in Victoria in 1919, and then loitering or soliciting for immoral purposes was outlawed in 1961. And both of these offences targeted so-called deviant sexual practices and gender presentations. In the 1950s, we saw the beginning of vice squads and the intensification of policing methods to curb and control homosexuality, including methods of entrapment via agent provocateurs and blackmail. State surveillance and prosecution of homosexual men drew from and reinforced emergent discourses of homosexuality in Australia as a problem for domestic security and national morality, or as a crime, sin, or even a biomedical disorder. For women, their queer desires were seen as filthy, obscene, or mad. Lesbian sexualities are often invisibilized in queer histories, and in large part that's a product of the way that legal records have been used to construct histories of queer criminalization. So historically, policing practices criminalized lesbian sexuality less vigorously than that of gay men. And throughout its legal history in Britain, sodomy was described as a crime not fit to be named. And women were explicitly excluded from the statute because of a fear that verbalizing such acts would make otherwise ignorant women aware of and therefore more prone to engage in such behavior. In 1921, the British House of Lords rejected the criminalization of lesbian acts because it was feared that the law would bring sexual practices to the attention of women who had never conceived of them before. This legacy extends to British settler colonies, including Canada, the USA, and Australia, where sodomy laws technically applied to women but were rarely enforced. However, this doesn't signal that lesbian sexualities escaped state control. The exclusion of women from sodomy laws reflects an alternative form of regulation that's premised on silencing or erasure. And these kinds of legal silences constitute a deliberate attempt to regulate lesbian sexuality through the very denial of its existence. So while gay men were policed and prosecuted for sodomy and other homosexual offences, there were other laws or mechanisms of regulation that were more likely to be used to criminalise, regulate and erase lesbian desires and gender non-conforming identities. For example, the lesbian working class bar scene in 1950s Melbourne was routinely subject to police harassment, threats and inaction when staff and patrons were abused by members of the public. Women were policed to ensure compliance with cross-dressing laws that stipulated women must have at least 3 items of feminine clothing at all times. Outside of criminal legal mechanisms, sexual and gender deviance was also subject to medical and psychiatric intervention in the mid-20th century of Australia, sometimes resulting in incarceration. So I think this reveals how historically lesbian and trans people didn't escape surveillance or punishment, but instead policing played a key role in shoring up, often violently, a dominant sexual and gendered social order. Formally, homosexuality was decriminalised in Victoria in 1981, but in a lot of ways that phrase is really misleading. So the last decade of the 20th century in Australia also saw the advent of prosecutions for so-called reckless HIV transmission in different Australian states, and that presented new avenues through which homosexual conduct could be criminalised and queer bodies could be reproduced as deviant and threatening. There's a lot of documentation of how queer public sex practices, such as BEAT activity, continue to be aggressively policed long after the abolition of sodomy laws in Victoria. So Victoria Police continued to conduct entrapment operations with plainclothes officers at beats well into the 1990s. And even in 2002, Operation Dalliance led to the arrest of over 100 men at Flinders Street Station in acts of entrapment and surveillance. So the really persistent police focus on the issue of public sex in particular between men suggests that any kinds of rights gains that queers have made through the law are actually pretty conditional and tenuous. So only certain kinds of private, respectable, monogamous sex can be validated or legitimised through the law, and those kinds of queer sex practices that don't conform to that heteronormative ideal of private monogamous coupling still is subject to state regulation and projections of deviance and forms of exclusion. I think some of the ongoing evidence of policing of queer sexualities highlights that criminalization of homosexuality was not actually an end point, but a kind of reworking of power, and particularly along those lines of privacy and sexual respectability. There's a lot of examples as well of queer culture itself being criminalized, and particularly because queer culture has always been so bound up with resistance cultures. And so, you know, I can think of an example from when I was interviewing some queer activists who were involved in queer anti-capitalist organizing in Melbourne in the late 90s and early 2000s. I spoke with Mark Pendleton about the police brutality against S11 demonstrators as really sharpening queer critiques of policing as an institution of violence. Some of the activists argued that police specifically targeted the queer bloc at the S11 protests. The lesbian and gay newspaper Melbourne Star Observer published one protester's account in an article titled Queer Bashings. The article said, "Tuesday morning there was one particular blockade that the police broke through with a baton charge and walked horses over sitting protesters, and that was actually the queer blockade. Another protester talked about being bashed along with 200 protesters and the police pushing through the line, not just pushing, but actually punching us, and reported that she got punched in the face by a police officer."
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show here on 3CR. We're going to continue listening to that excerpt from the Queer Histories, Queer Future podcast.
I used to live in East Melbourne. A very short walk for three principal venues in my life, those being the Laird Hotel, which may as well have been described as my lounge room. I liked going to the Laird a lot. The Peel Hotel, which was great for a dance. And Club 80, which is a no longer existing sex on premises venue in Melbourne. And at the time, I'm thinking about in the early 90s, I used to have a penchant for leather, as I enjoyed wearing leather. And I could wear the entire catastrophe, or I could be quite brief. But not unusual to have the leather cap, the leather shirt, the leather vest or the leather jacket with something on the right-hand side, epaulette of the jacket, so that no one be, you know, mistaken that I be described as heavily butch. I'd be wearing the leather jeans or the leather chaps, and in the right back pocket a variety of bandanas flowing and leather boots. Now, I would regularly walk, say, to the Laird. After the Laird, go to the Peel for a cocktail, then up to Club 80, perhaps for sex, but more often for a lot of S&M, in this instance, standing and modelling, because Club 80 was a sex venue where, you know, people picked up or they didn't. And then when it was time to go home, I would walk home and I'd walk across East Melbourne. And for months on end, every single night, a police car would cruise past me and say, "Oh, excuse me, sir. Do you have any ID? What are you doing dressed like that? What are you doing out in the streets dressed like that?" You know, and the numerous times of, "Well, I'm going from Club 80, and I know you know where that is, to my house in East Melbourne, and you asked me the same question last night and the night before, and you asked me the same night on Saturday and Friday and Thursday. And I know you're going to ask me the same question tomorrow." And it was never too threatening, but it was threatening to the extent that, why be picked on all the time? And when you hear stories about people in St Kilda or people in Smith Street, Fitzroy, or in other locations who feel they are being picked on by security forces, whether it's police or security in a venue, it can be very intimidating because that's what it's intended to do. And eventually they stopped picking on me. But I think horribly they probably started picking on someone else.
I think we're in an interesting moment where part of what inspired me to do this research into the contemporary history of queer relations to police organisations was the seeming disjuncture between radical queer histories contesting police violence and contesting state intrusion into our lives, and the seeming contemporary embrace of police organisations at mainstream LGBTIQA plus events and initiatives. Not even just the acceptance, but the active celebration of policing as an institution. So I remember being a young queer organising in solidarity with prisoners, in solidarity with Indigenous groups, all of whom have very explicitly and continually been actively targeted by the institution of policing in really violent ways. Being involved in that as an act of queer solidarity was something that really shaped my politics around policing. And then attending a gay pride march in St Kilda and seeing Victoria Police being celebrated and revered for their progress and their achievements. And so a lot of my work has been trying to understand the way that select sanitized versions of queer sexuality and non-normative gender expressions have been able to be incorporated into state power through the institution of police, and how that really actively reproduces the exclusion of other forms of queerness and non-normativity or of deviance that will always be sitting outside the kind of white supremacist heteronormative ideal of Australian citizenship. So I think, yeah, there's a real risk for queer communities to be absorbed into the apparatus of power that is policing, and in a way that bolsters that power rather than weakening it. And I think that's a real loss for queer movements who have always had opportunities to be in solidarity with other marginalised groups by virtue of our kind of liminal status and excluded status. So I think the future of queer carceral justice, as you might put it, is about recognising and building upon those histories and futures of solidarity with other over-policed groups, and kind of keeping in mind or reckoning with what the conditions or limits are to queer inclusion into the state.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show here at 3CR on 855 AM on the dial, or on 3CR via the Community Plus radio app. That was just an excerpt from the Queer Histories, Queer Future podcast, a 3CR series made in collaboration with the Mary Beck Council, telling the area's queer history by the people who made it. Up next, we're going to hear an excerpt from an interview by Marissa from the Doin' Time show here at 3CR. She will speak to Beau Spearham, a First Nation activist and podcaster, about the frontier wars, police powers and Aboriginal deaths in custody.
This is a quote from Beau Spearham, creator and host of a podcast called Frontier War Stories. The podcast is dedicated to truth-telling about a side of Australian history that has been left out of the history books. Each episode, he speaks with different First Nations and non-Indigenous people about research, books and oral histories that document the first 140 years of conflict and resistance after European invasion. I'd like to welcome Beau to the show to have a yarn about all this. And personally, I really love having Beau on the show because he's so knowledgeable, and I really enjoy talking to him and learning about what happened in the Frontier Wars. Hi, Beau.
Hey, how you going, Marissa?
Lovely to have you. I'm just recovering from bronchitis, but we've got to keep going.
That's good.
Now, can you tell us, first of all, what land you're on?
Yep. So just real quickly, Yama, Bo Spearum, Gumarai Kuma, Marawari, born in Western Sydney, grew up on the south side of Brisbane, and my old man is from Maureen, from a mission, and my mum, she's from Brewarrina in Gadigal, from Mission and Reserve, where she spent her early days in her childhood. But yeah, on Yuggera country, this is home.
So there's been quite a lot of things happening, isn't there, about truth telling and you know, the frontier wars have not really been put too much in the media, have they?
No. And yeah, I think you could look at that as a deliberate thing as well. It's a tool that colonizers use as a tool of colonialism, you know, not to, you know, as they say, the victors, you know, tell history. And so that's how sort of they have gone about telling the history in this country, deliberately leaving out not just the horrors of what happened on the frontier, but also the courageous, brave, honourable sacrifices of Aboriginal men and women all over this country who laid the ultimate sacrifice for us to be here today and for us to still continue that struggle.
Absolutely. It's so important. Can you, in case we've got new listeners that don't really know, mm-hmm. are you able to just tell us what are the frontier wars exactly?
Definitely. The frontier, as it's sort of known, and it's sort of those early period of time, especially when the British or other sort of colonial powers back then were, and I'm not going to say finding, but invading many Indigenous nations. You know, I think in America, it was called, like, you know, it sort of marks this period of time where explorers, you know, are sent out to look for lands that are fertile, that are, you know, in abundance of resources and is livable. And then there's these phases in that frontier period, which are invasion, and then, I don't know if you feel like settlement, like that period of staying and setting up and establishing a colony.
Yes.
And then the stage of continuing, like, that period of war and invasion and assimilation, which is another form of that kind of later stages of, I guess, the frontier, but also that part of in the invasion sort of whether it's British, the Spanish, or whatever nation wants to sort of take over Indigenous lands. And here in particular, it was a very fast and brutal process, you know, from about 1788 up until like the 1940s, well into the beginning of what now has become Australia, you know, well after the foundation of this country. They were still planning and executing massacres of Aboriginal people, forcing mob off specific land and shipping them to missions and reserves, which, you know, we still call concentration camps in this country as blackfellas. You know, and within that period of time, there was battles, wars that were fought all over this country. And when we think of wars, you know, and I guess what we're taught to be wars, we look at, you know, I guess World War One, Two, Vietnam, Iraq, you know, like all these, you know, wars that the West are involved in. And then we get told, oh, no, it wasn't a war, it was just like a skirmish here, there and everywhere. But in that time, you know, now and for quite a period of time, there's always been evidence to say that, you know, these were legitimate sort of wars in different parts of this country and were described as such by squatters and by military sort of personnel, with those soldiers. You know, there was governors who described, you know, wanting to take Aboriginal people as prisoners of war. And, you know, those soldiers who were in combat against Aboriginal people, you know, they were veterans of military campaigns in other parts of the world that Britain was involved in. So, you know, it wasn't as if they were just sort of soldiers on some kind of peacekeeping mission to secure land for Britain. No, they were over here with instructions to exterminate any kind of resistance from Aboriginal people at any time, at any place. And majority of the times when it was on the terms of Aboriginal people, Aboriginal people defeated, you know, soldiers and had the upper hand. And then there's a whole discussion around, you know, the discussion of warfare and how Europeans would go to war and how blackfellas over here would go to war as well. Like, you know, the Western side of war is to just invade, kill everything, destroy the land, take prisoners or just kill. Where the concept of war over here, and maybe, I don't know, maybe with most Indigenous folks around the world, it was in a controlled space. You know, there were people who sort of overlooked how this war between nations would have went. It wasn't just sort of a sort of battle of, you know, I'm going to kill and take everything and, you know, usurp their power, their people, their land, their sovereignty. It was never a thing like that. It was always, to solve conflicts between, like, Indigenous peoples. And then usually after that, it would be a ceremony and it would be like a process of coming together.
I see, yep.
Yeah, like for us Kumori fellas, we went to war with Bundjalung. They were one of our nearest nations. Or, you know, we would always go to war with them fellas. But at the end of that war, what we did was our two nations came together and we have a dance, a war dance we do, where one half of the dance Kumori do and the other half of the dance the Bundjalung fellas do as well. And so this was a similar way to squash, you know, conflicts between nations and also marriage, you know, the trading of symbols and all those other things as well. Yeah.
So you actually did a beautiful ritual to, you know, people did a beautiful ritual back then to actually help with dissolving conflict. Whereas, you know, you've got the colonists who formulated specific operational responses to Indigenous resistance.
Definitely,
and that means,
you know,
denial of their existence, terra nullis, didn't it?
Totally, and we're in a very unique position here, you know, in what is so-called Australia, because we were sort of left, I guess you could say, to our own devices in regards to how we use and how we work with this land, but also how we work with each other as blackfellas. You know, we're a continent that is solely, I guess, you know, not connected to any other kind of landmass, where, you know, you have, you know, like Russia, China, India, you know, Africa, like the Middle East, even like the Americas kind of thing. Like they're all, you know, one huge continent, a lot going on. And but we've sort of had to, you know, deal with each other for so long. We've had the time to sort of, what's the word, like, work out governance structures here and, you know, humanize how we interact with each other in on levels that take into consideration, like, battles and wars, you know, like, even in those instances when we had those conflicts with each other, it wasn't to take over or to usurp or to enslave people.
And that's a really good point that you make, Bo, because that's actually not said too much in the mainstream media. It's always about the negatives, and it's really great that you've been able to talk about.
Well, and then that goes back to that part that we were talking about in regards to the narrative that they want to tell. The victors tell history, so they want to tell a history where we were just savages, we gave up the land, we didn't want it, and in today's society we're just criminals, we're victims, you know, we're poor people, you know, we're a dying race, and all this other crap that they want to say as well. And that's played into the hands of the majority of white fellas in this country where, you know, whether they've met black fellas or not, that's a perceived notion that they have in their head about black fellas.
absolutely.
Sadly, you know, and that's, you know, that's the narrative and that's the story they've told for so long, so that's why so many Australians, to this day, will continue to normalise racism towards black fellas in this country and justify so many different things, whether it's, you know, black fellas dying in custody, if they just done what the cop was told them to do, then they wouldn't have died, or, you know, what is she now? She's the opposition leader, Susan Lane. When she was the environmental minister years ago, she was involved in discussions in regards to mining companies or my country, Gumar country. I don't know if it was Shenmire or Whitehaven. She did a quote where she said that the economic benefit from this mining project outweighs the cultural significance of the Gumari people. You know, so this is not just what and how people see us, but also how they see the land and how they value the land as well. So this is, you know, why they think so low of us in this country. It's because it's been this long narrative that's been told since these fellows have jumped the ship. You know, like...
Exactly.
Like all Indigenous and black folks around the world, you know, like with whether it's like Darwin's theory of human evolution, we were always seen as sort of the last, you know, the sort of smallest brains and like the lowest in sort of the evolutional scale as well. And, you know, like that still continues to this day, that narrative. And that's why we had, you know, bloody Nazis all over this country and rednecks on the 31st, the last month, you know, carrying on to think they own this country.
Well, look at all the Nazis that have risen, and there was an attack on camp sovereignty as well.
That's it, you know, and this notion that, oh, you know, where is this country going? It's like, oh, hold on, wait a minute, this country has always been like this. You know, like, the difference with nowadays and back then is, like, we, you know, can film racism. It's just those who justify it, you know, now on social media.
3CR, stay tuned, stay radical.
We demand the full restoration of all Indigenous lands and resources, and we demand the immediate cessation of all forms of exploitation and destruction of our lands.
We're here to remind you of our sovereignty and our original demand from day one.
Started with intentional genocide of our people around the round table in England. It's all lies here. everything's a lie. It's a great opportunity right now. Step into a sovereign, independent republic.
We demand a treaty. We demand our lands back. We demand to stop Black Death in custody.
Before that station ID, that was Marissa from the Doin' Time show here at 3CR. To listen to the rest of that conversation and more of Doin' Time, go to 3cr.org.au/Doin' Time, D-O-I-N-T-I-M-E. And you can tune in to Doin' Time later at 4 to 5pm today at 855 on the dial or at 3CR on the Community Plus radio app.
3CR.
Following this Friday's announcement of the 2025 Nobel Peace Prize, there has been widespread comment and celebration of US President Trump not winning the award. But have we heard this much about the winner's own politics or history? This year's award was given to a woman by the name of Maria Corina Machado, who has joined previous Nobel Peace Prize winners Henry Kissinger and Barack Obama in the Hall of Fame. We will now feature excerpts from three reports from Tuesday home time on the 2024 presidential elections in Venezuela and Machado's role in relation to U.S. interests in the country. Broadcast in August and October last year, we will now hear three subject matter experts, Dr. Sasha Gillies-Lakakis, Dr. Tim Anderson, and Coral Winter, with their analyses of first-hand accounts of the elections.
If we consider the violence and the depravity of the right-wing opposition, perhaps some of these more hard-handed actions become a little bit more at least understandable, because, you know, there have been instances where Bolivarian police have used restraint and they have ended up being killed by right-wing protesters. So a very, very tragic situation. All of this, mind you, funded by the United States and their local proxies. And the sanctions and this violence led to a severe economic crisis in Venezuela ever since really 2015. Venezuela has been in a state of severe crisis. We've seen large exodus of people leaving the country due to the situation, much like the case of Cuba. As we said, the rationale is the same, that it's to cause so much hardship and suffering that the people abandon the socialist project, that the people abandoned Maduro and the Bolivarian Revolution. But of course they didn't. Most people, still a majority, it's a smaller majority now because of how difficult the situation got, but it is still a majority of Venezuelans did not abandon Maduro. The US has resorted to all manner of insane schemes since that time to try and remove him. We had the declaration of Juan Guaido in 2019, who was an opposition businessman, essentially, who then became self-proclaimed president. And surprise, surprise, the US and not even all European countries, some European countries and Australia recognized him as the president, even though he has never won a single election and never won an election with even a simple majority. Nothing. But he was declared president. He was recognized as such by the United States. The rest of the world didn't care about him because they knew that Maduro was the one who had been winning elections, and he sunk into obscurity. In fact, most of his electoral team was arrested for corruption. So that just goes to show you the type of people that the US is relying upon. There was then an attempted assassination by drone in 2020 at a procession where Maduro was inspecting the armed forces. A drone flew down and tried to shoot Maduro or drop explosives on Maduro. And then we had the very, very bizarre Operation Gideon in the same year, which was also known as the Bay of Piglets because it was reminiscent of the Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba, where US mercenaries tried to stage an invasion of Venezuela. They landed on the Caribbean coast and intended to kidnap Nicolas Maduro. Now, of course, this was totally insane, this plan. They were arrested very, very easily, in fact, by fishermen, by local fishermen who form part of these grassroots networks that report to the government in Venezuela, and that was botched again.
Coral, as I mentioned, it's a while since the Venezuelan presidential elections. The hoo-ha about it and the denigration of the Maduro government continues. When exactly was it?
The presidential elections, were held on 28th of July 2024. The elections are for a six-year term. The winner will take power on the 10th of January 2025. Now, the US government began their propaganda machine against Venezuela months before this. In March, even, the Miami Herald declared already the fraudulent Venezuelan election. So what happened is the US government wanted their candidate, Maria Corina Machado, to run. She was disqualified earlier by the Venezuelan government as she advocated for the US government to invade Venezuela and supported the sanctions, which probably resulted in the death of 100,000 Venezuelans because of lack of medical supplies. She also called on Netanyahu to join in the invasion of Venezuela. And she was disqualified by the Venezuelan government to run because she's the most reactionary, vicious member of the Venezuelan opposition. But that was the US preferred candidate. Anyhow, so the opposition chose an elderly ex-diplomat, Edmundo Gonzalez, but Machado was behind him all the way.
Tim, were you there much before the election and much after?
Well, I went for a week, and most of it was before the election, up to one day after the election. I was part of a large group, over 1,000 international invited guests. Amongst others, there were some seminars, but also to be observers at the election. The US, of course, has a long history of coups and interventions in Latin America, and the extremist side of the Venezuelan opposition has always been hoping for that. So here they were trying to hedge their bets. So they thought, well, we'll try and we'll participate and, you know, assuage the concern of our supporters who actually want us to participate and try and get advantage through elections. But if that doesn't work, we'll fall back on a coup, deep destabilization strategy.
And who is Edmundo Gonzalez?
It's a fair question. He's in a poll in April this year, half of Venezuelans had never heard of him, basically. But he's been a character around for some time. He's a little bit of a Biden-esque sort of character because he's 75, but he's also a little bit slow and doddery. But he has a history. He was actually a CIA agent back in the 80s, and he was involved in organizing the death squads in Central America. If you remember that, there were with a similar type of U.S. intervention in Central American politics, there were death squads that were organized for opponents of the right-wing regimes in El Salvador and Guatemala, for that matter. So he was a CIA asset back then, back in the day. But since then, he became a figure in Venezuela who was really the front man for a woman called Maria Corina Machado, who is the effective leader these days of the Venezuelan opposition, or the extremist side of the Venezuelan opposition. Now, she became very well known for being a supporter of George W. Bush when George W. Bush backed the 2002 coup attempt against Hugo Chavez. And she had an organization called Samate, which was funded by the U.S. government through the National Endowment for Democracy. And so she herself eventually was disqualified from running as a candidate under the law there because she'd been involved in supporting the so-called economic sanctions against Venezuela, which were aggressions against the government, the creation of a fake government under Juan Guaido, which allowed the U.S. With Guaido to steal the foreign assets of Venezuela, Citgo, the petroleum refining outfit in the U.S., and the store of gold reserves held by the Bank of England. So very, very serious damage to the Venezuelan state. Because of that, she was disqualified by the legal authorities from standing. She'd also been a diplomat for a little while for Panama, and being a diplomat for a foreign power is a disqualification under the Venezuelan constitution too. So she herself could not run. So she effectively was the organizer, and they hadn't charged her criminally with any of these things, which they could have. The U.S. will say that Maduro is banning his candidates. Well, actually, if someone in the U.S. was an opposition candidate who was a diplomat for a foreign country, they'd be in jail, in fact, with a death penalty hanging over them under the treason laws of the U.S. So many countries would have jailed someone like her, but because of the history of so many opposition figures being involved in these extremist events and the desire, I guess, of the Venezuelan body politics to try and reconcile those conflicts within the political class. She wasn't arrested or jailed yet. But anyway, she became the leader, and Edmundo González, this character, became the actual candidate. But everyone knew that basically it was a joint operation, basically.
There were also eight other candidates, which they never mentioned, but because the US called the elections undemocratic, you know, dictatorial results, and that was that hoo-ha, that they couldn't run the candidate they wanted to. But Machado was just impossible. You know, no government would choose such a candidate to be able to legally run an election. So on the night of July 28th, there was a massive cyber attack on 126 digital platforms of the Venezuelan government. And the most significant of these was the CNE, that is the National Electoral Council. And this is Venezuela's constitutional agency that records the vote. It was hacked 100 times that night. It could not operate normally, delaying the release of the results for days. There were 30 million cyber attacks per minute, which occurred between July 28th and August 9th. So it disabled the Venezuelan government computer system and paralyzed operations. The voting system in Venezuela is just incredible. As you go in, you use a thumbprint, so there's no duplication of voting. And there's a manual paper record as well, made at the same time as the computer record, so that it can be checked at each booth if there's any problem. So the result was that Edmundo González, the opposition, declared that they had won the vote by 70% to 30% of Maduro. So they created the conditions that, because of the hacking of the computers, that Maduro had stolen the vote, and the opposition under Machado called on people to protest and created these guerrillas, which is these small groups that attack all sorts of organisations. The groups were paid by USAID, and to instigate violence, they burnt buildings, they sacked several CNE headquarters, blocked roads, attacked police and the military, beat up people who looked like activists, attacked local community leaders, food distribution centres, public schools, hospitals, the transport system, all to paralyse the country. The US media could then portray to the world, you know, a picture of national chaos, inviting military intervention to restore order, meaning another US neo-colonial regime. On top of this, Machado called on the Venezuelan army to rebel. 25 people were killed and 192 people wounded. So that's what happened immediately after the election.
So Maduro has survived many, many, many things that most other governments and most other presidents would not be forced to deal with. He's dealt with economic crisis, foreign intervention, foreign invasion, violent attempts on his life. And he is still there. And he has still won every election since that time. Now, the most recent one was, of course, Nicolas Maduro against, well, first it was going to be Maria Conchalo. She's a piece of work, if I can be frank. She's a fascist, self-described, very proud member of Opus Dei, a far-right Catholic organization, promoted all manner of conspiracies against the Bolivarian Revolution, essentially one of the number one paid proxies of the US in Venezuela. Very, very vindictive woman, has been caught on television and in interviews saying openly racist comments against Afro-Venezuelans and indigenous Venezuelans. She is essentially the epitome of the Venezuelan elite, that criollo, that white elite, Spanish descendants, that still holds on to these delusions of grandeur, of somehow clawing back control of the country and control of the oil industry so that they can once again benefit from the immense wealth that is sitting off the coast of Venezuela and in the ground and in the earth of Venezuela. She was disqualified for inciting violence and, again, for corruption. And these charges were easily proven. Her party is riddled with corruption. And she herself, she was originally an engineer and then she has since become a very wealthy businesswoman. Her businesses have been under investigation for a long time, some of them even before Chavez took power, which just goes to show how deep-rooted her corruption is and how compromised she is. They then opted to place Edmundo González, who was a pre-Bolivarian diplomat, so again, belonging to the old regime, and they put him in charge of the campaign, and he became their presidential candidate. Now, the election resulted in Maduro's victory, much more narrow this time, which, considering the situation in Venezuela, does make sense. Maduro won about 51% of the vote, 52%, and González won 44%. So still commanding a majority. Maduro still clearly commanding the confidence of the majority of Venezuelans, even if by a much slimmer margin. What did the opposition do? I was thinking, surely they won't do this again. Surely they won't just declare themselves the winner, declare González president, and essentially, you know, say, oh, the vote was stolen. We actually won almost all of the vote. I thought, surely they will not resort to this playbook again. But they did. They did exactly the same thing. They said Maduro did not win. González, they said, won 70% of the vote without providing any evidence. They said he won 70%, which is just ridiculous when you consider the demographics in Venezuela. And they said, yep, he's the president. Edmundo González is the president. They did exactly what they did with Juan Guaido, some reason thinking that it will be successful this time, that something different will eventuate. They called, you know, substantial protests explicitly this time. The right-wing protesters were caught killing people. There was very, very little violence on the part of the Bolivarian police. In fact, a number of police were killed by the right-wing protesters in the past weeks.
Well, we're nearly 3 months later, Coral. What's the situation now?
González has fled to Spain, and Machado has presented no evidence to fraud and a 70% vote. And a 500,000 people on August the 3rd marched in support of Maduro. So there were not fair elections. Basically, Maduro is running a war economy against massive US sanctions. And we have to remember Obama declared Venezuela a threat to US national security in 2015. And it continued, that continued, of course, under Trump. Maduro went to the elections with the imperialist gun held at his head.
So the US recognized González, most of Europe recognized González, most of Latin America recognized González, and they're all run by right-wing proxies of the US as well. But the rest of the world has not. The rest of the world recognizes Maduro, is continuing to do business with Maduro, and Maduro, by all intents and purposes, has weathered this storm, it seems. They often say for a color revolution or regime change, the first 48 hours are critical, and if enough momentum can be gained in those 48 hours, it's possible to overthrow a government. But that didn't happen. It's been weeks now, and these cries of fraud and, you know, these auto-proclamations of the right wing having the presidency, they just seem desperate and they seem pathetic and they seem out of touch for most Venezuelans and for most other countries. So people don't take them seriously. It's so, so transparent that it's the same playbook that the right wing has always used in Venezuela. What we can see is the Bolivarian Revolution continues. It's under siege. It's embattled. But it is going to continue.
We have to keep in mind that US imperialism is intent on regime change in Venezuela. This involves lies, false propaganda, funding the right-wing reactionaries through the NGOs and US aid, by any means possible. Venezuela is still a beacon for what other progressive governments can do to try and overcome the domination and the stealing of their wealth by the US government. You can't wipe Venezuela off the map. You have to see there's no middle area between US imperialism and the barbarism that it will produce. There's no middle ground. We have to support the Venezuelan government.
You're listening to 3CR Breakfast, and we have been listening to three reports that were broadcasted on 3CR Tuesday Home Time last year, outlining the context behind the recently announced Nobel Peace Prize winner, Maria Corina Machado, and her role in Venezuela and its 2024 elections. Now, a year and a half on from the elections, Nicolas Maduro continues his presidency with popular support despite ongoing aggressions from US President Trump, to whom Machado dedicated her Nobel Peace Prize. We recommend listeners to hear these conversations in full, which you will find in this week's Monday Breakfast podcast on the 3CR website. And make sure to tune in to Tuesday Home Time for more in-depth interviews every Tuesday from 4 to 6 p.m. on 3CR Community Radio. That brings us to the end of the show. Before that, we heard Marissa interviewing Bo Spearum on the Do and Time show here at 3CR on the Frontier Wars, Police Powers and Aboriginal Deaths in Custody. And before that, we heard an excerpt from Queer History's Queer Futures podcast about criminalisation of the LGBTQIA plus community. And then before that, we heard on the we heard an excerpt from the Yilliman show where Kieran was sharing his analysis of liberalism and how liberal ideology manifests both politically and socially through our daily life in so-called Australia. And firstly, on the show, we heard an interview from Indigenous Rights Radio with Joseph Lee, a traditional owner of Massachusetts in the US. We have been the Monday Breakfast Show here at 3CR, and stay tuned for Women on the Line.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.